all insensibility, when your soul, your companion speaks, those basic elements which are the sum total of everyone. Death, for example. In many beautiful poems centering around women's experiences, the poet shows us death, makes us know him. The Ballad of the Light-Eyed Little Girl is an especially beautiful example. A little girl named Sally is about to bury her sister, who died not because Sally didn't love her, but simply because Sally didn't know how to take care of her. The cruel wind seems to vocalize her feelings of guilt at having forgotten to feed the little bird. The finality of death, the futility of guilt, are sharp as steel in these lines. She has taken her captive pigeon core. She has buried him down and down. He never shall sally to sally, nor soil in the roots of his hand. Other views of death are carried in other poems. Old Mary, the short poem, in which an old woman, conscious of impending death, lives in the present and canceled over the death. Jessie Nichols' mother speaks of an old woman dying slowly, day by day, who remembers the day when she was young and lovely. Lovelier, she thinks, than the dark-skinned daughter in her character. Perhaps the most moving, most concise portrait of death occurs in a short poem called The Last Portraying of the Ballad of Emmett Till, After the Murder, After the Bird. And that goes like this. Emmett's mother is a pretty safe thing, the kiss of cool passage. She sits in the red room, drinking black coffee. She kisses her killed boy, and she is sorry. Chaos and windy rage to a weird kid. Other timeless themes are exploited through the experience of a woman. Racism is a frequent theme. I particularly moved by the story of Emmett Till, told through the viewpoint of a white woman, at whom 14-year-old Emmett was deposed with her sister, and for whom really quite honor Emmett was missed. A poem called A Bronzeville Mother Loiters in Mississippi, meanwhile a Mississippi mother burns vacant. Here's a Mississippi woman preparing breakfast for her brood in ordinary act after this horrible thing that has happened. This white Mississippi mother relives the whole thing as a romantic epic in which she is the milk-white maid, her husband the fine prince, and the murdered boy the dark villain. But the very real horror of it all breaks through. The brutality of Southern racism, the use of the victim, the agony of black mother. Through dissecting the heart of this woman, the poet reveals its ugliness, the sickness, the terrible danger of American racism. There are many other poems which reveal the effects of racism through a woman's eyes. And the method describes with the woman's sensibility the sight of the residents of a tenement building, especially the women. Mrs. Sal, the mother of many children, and apparently the wife of nobody. Yvonne, who wants to be married, the missing little girl, Katita, who is finally found, raped and murdered. Some poems deal ironically with the stupid little convention, the empty pretension of the haves and the posed and have nots. Fall in the Front Yard, for example, tells of a clean, middle-class little girl whose mother will not allow her to play with the children in fact. Yet, those children are there, and their life is good in many ways. The poem expresses the Front Yard little girl yearning for one year with herself. have said and tried to demonstrate and it's been very sick to kind of work, is that when Brooks works reflect deeply her experiences as a black woman and the sensitivity that these experiences have developed. She explores the various relationships and roles significant to women, and she reveals basic human truth through a woman's eyes. The definition of the complexity of experience of the black woman has such deep meaning to us all that we are deprived to the extent that the definition is sufficient. This is a challenge which all black writers, men as well as women, must ultimately face. Only when we face this challenge can our image of ourselves be heard.
And we come this time at the door of great opportunity, and for some reason we seem to be losing that great opportunity. Our oppressor has lost the world by default, but we don't seem to know that. And we are the next people scared to become the arena of world power, and we don't seem to know that either. At the risk of telling an old story that I've told maybe too many times, but I don't think the lesson has been learned. And one thing about pathological teachers, and I am the one who started my upbringing down the road in Columbus, Georgia. My students said that I'm really an aspiring Baptist preacher who never really made it to the pulpit. Sometimes they come to the session and I'm going to hear Reverend Clark's sermon. Now, before I begin, I merely want to see if I can put in some kind of perspective what has brought us to this tragic and fortunate and confusing state in history, searching forever outside of ourselves for our salvation. Willis Harrison, one of my better teachers, told me that we would have no difficulty getting to the door of the promised land. If we can get to the door of the promised land, then we will bunch up at the door and argue about whether to cross the threshold with our right foot or our left. And that is not the point. The point is to get across the threshold. What he was trying to illustrate is how horrible it is for people to be out of power too long. They long desperately for power. And when they get close to power, they panic. They panic because they run out of excuse. You can't blame your oppressor anymore. And while you were longing for power, deep inside of you, you never thought you would have to handle it in your lifetime. And so you're thinking about how you will handle power, what I'm going to do when I get into power. Just empty ego washing that you never thought you could have approved. And all of a sudden, in your own lifetime, a set of circumstances, plus some of your ranking, your rating, and your endurance, have put you on the side of the stage, ready to come on, and to act on the stage is stale and old. And the audience is tired of it, and they want a new man on the stage, meaning the stage of power. Now, because of this internal conflict about the yearning for power and the fear of power, We have begun to search outside of ourselves for a methodology of handling power and neglect the basic theoretician among ourselves who told us over 100 years ago how to go about it. What I'm trying to focus on is this sad and sometimes silly fight between blacks over masculinity. Search for an ideology, searching forever among the stale leadings of other people and neglecting your own theoretician who told you clearer than Mark Elkhorn how we would have to go and whose basic approach to our problem was social. Edmund Blyton checked out some of the same books in London as Karl Marx and arrived at different conclusions because he was speaking from a different historical, political, and ethnic vantage point. Let's make one thing clear before we go any further. I am a committed soldier. I am also a committed madman. I am also a committed pan-African. I see no conflict between the three. I see them working very well together. And I have no internal conflict over the three. And other people who have conflicts over combining the three have artificial conflict because there is no conflict. Now, the search for an ideology referred to here is a recurring theme in the history of African people in general, and the people of the world in particular. Because our memories are short, we are not creatively converted history into an instrument of our liberation. Most of us do not know that there was no ideology in the world until we created one. Therefore, our search for an ideology is a search for our lost values, culturally, politically, and socially. There are no people without an ideology, as there are no people without a culture. People create an ideology just by living. It is something they do, like breathing is something they do. And in the same way, they create a culture. Whether they ever hear a telephone or whether they ever wear a shoe. The collective reaction of man to his environment and his way of dealing with that environment is both his ideology and his culture. It is sometimes people sometimes acquire from other people ideologies partly beneficial to them and ideologies detrimental to them. One ideology that fits one people and may well be ideal for that people may be disaster for another people, depending on the culture vantage point, the ethnic vantage point, and the political vantage point. Ideologies come in many forms from negative to positive. Our search for a positive ideology. We search for an ideology of liberation. An ideology that asks and must answer the question, how will my people stay on this earth? An ideology of survival. And that ideology must serve you first. And whether it serves other people is somewhat incidental, so long as it serves you first. If it serves you and serves the whole world at the same time, then good for the whole world. But I created it first to serve myself, to serve me and mine. Now, this essential selfishness of survival is what brought Europe to power that first time, and what brought Europe to power that second time, and what keeps European people in power right now. That looking after self and not caring if other people are looked at. The thing about us is that we do care. We do care. And there are a few times in history where we have looked after ourselves at the expense of other people. A precious few times in history. When you find the strongest thing about people, look for the weakest thing also because they are closer today. The strongest thing about black people is their humanity. The weakest thing about black people is their inability to place that humanity in proper focus and proper perspective for their own survival. And this is why, in the history of African people, he nearly always invites his future conqueror against him. I have traced this back 3,000 years, and I was just being conservative. And because I encourage my students to revolt, very often they take my word and revolt and say, please don't tell us we are that naive. We have not invited everybody to dinner. Then I go back to that bunch of nomads called the Shepherd King who invaded Egypt and brought in a people called the Jews, to the Assyrians, to the Greeks, all of them were in Africa as guests. 50 years before, kids in the jungle. Then they left the home of the African host, went home and showed their own people how to kill the African host. I can document it. I dare not say a single thing that I cannot prove. I make my living, I pay mortgages, I pay for shoes. I can't afford to look for that. The tragedy of our present position is that we are searching for an ideology among second and third grade people who got their ideology, their religion, and the basis of their culture originally from us. If we understood this, there would be no conflict among us over Marxism, Leninism, and socialism. This ideology was old among us before Europe was born. Before the first and second rise of Europe in the 15th century, most of the people in the non-European world lived in societies or communal soldiers. These societies had existed in Asia, throughout most of Africa, Polynesia, perfect societies based on giving to each man according to his needs. The black intellects, young and old, are now engaged in an ideological battle that is a sad waste of our time at a very critical period in our history. Everybody who has been doing any thinking lately knows that there is no place for the world to go politically except in some form of socialism. Men of vision and intelligence with the knowledge of history no longer debate this point. My argument with this new mafia crew calling themselves Marx and Leninists is that they are not Marx and Leninists. I doubt whether they can distinguish between Karl Marx and the comedian Groucho Marx.